All right, everyone. Happy New Year. Welcome to the first Pox Populi Telegram stream of 2023. That was Carreg Lafar leading us in with the song Marie Louis, which is a, it means the Grey Woman or Grey Mary. And it's a typical Welsh, well, I guess not typical, but it's a Welsh festival. Or a Welsh ritual, Welsh wassailing celebration that takes place around these dates, the first week of December, ending on this day, usually the 5th of January, going into the 6th of January. Here in Spain, this is the day that they celebrate the arrival of the three wise men, or as they're known here, the Magic Kings, Los Reyes Magos. In Italy, tonight at midnight, the witch, La Befana, will be delivering presents to good children in Italian towns and villages. And coal, charcoal, to the bad children. So I hope you had a very good Christmas time, Yuletide time. I hope you had a very pleasant welcoming in of 2023. Just let me get into the chat here. All right, Reed Johnson is here. Garius is here. Great. Good to see you both. Angry European is here. Nice name. I like that. All right. Okay, good. Okay, so like I said, hope you're all doing okay. Hope you had a good holiday time. Did you do anything special to ring in the new year, to celebrate Yule? I kept it pretty tranquil this year, pretty low key. I just had dinner with the in-laws, and then on New Year's Eve, again, went over to the in-laws and had a sip of champagne at midnight, and that was pretty much it. Too old for the old festivities now, the old parties. tonight, actually, you might even hear this in the background. Tonight in the village, in the town, there's going to be the cabalgata, the parade of the three wise men, the three kings, winding its way through the town streets. They have a bunch of floats and there's a bunch of kids dressed up on them, and then the main floats are all the main attraction on the big floats is, of course, the three kings. And in previous times, there would be, you know, the two I guess Caucasian kings, and then there would be one who would always put himself in blackface to represent, I believe it's Balthasar, the African king. And of course, given the times we live in now, given political correctness even becoming a major component now of European culture, not just American or Anglosphere culture, now that's not really it's not really done these days. Usually I think some towns will even like hire in someone to play the brown-skinned or dark-skinned Balthazar. Or if you live in a larger town with a more multi-ethnic population, they'll find the local Moro and ask him to do it. All right. So here's what we're going to do tonight on tonight's stream. I think you're going to enjoy it. We are going to have a reading of Greg Johnson's essay or article that he wrote for Countercurrents last week. Last week, he wrote a very, very good article that just so happened to be about something that frequent listeners of this live stream and members of my Telegram channel will know. That is, it's something that I have been talking about a lot as well. And it's the theme of ethnic ethnocentric nations, nations as defined by Herodotus, a people with a shared blood, shared language, shared customs, and shared religion, more or less. And that, in contrast to imperialism, or even you know, what I would say the proto-globalist modern nation states that we have today, and the idea of, you know, expansionism, of a white super state, that sort of thing. So because I've been talking about this for such a long time, I really thought that this was rather fitting that Greg wrote this essay. And whatever you think about Greg Johnson, you know, I remember I disagreed with him at the height of COVID and COVID restrictions. But I think, and I know some people have other problems, they take issue with other things. I don't really care about all of that. I think that Greg has consistently been a solid and sound voice on our side of things. And I, in particular, agree wholeheartedly with what he said in this article that he wrote last week. So I'm going to read Greg Johnson's article tonight, and then we can discuss it together ourselves. And then also, of course, any comments or questions, different ideas, different things you'd like to talk about, go ahead and send them in the Pax Populi chat on Telegram. Or you can also send in a super chat. The link to the super chat is on my Telegram channel on the post that is pinned. So you can just send it there. And I see that Reed Johnson has just sent the link as well. And with all of that said, let's get started. So Greg begins. One of the fundamental divisions in the white nationalist movement is between ethno-nationalists and imperialists. Ethno-nationalists want a world in which every distinct people has the right to a sovereign homeland. Imperialists want a single white racial state. Wilmot Robertson makes the case for ethno-nationalism in his book, The Ethno-State, whereas Francis Parker Yockey presents the case for imperialism in Imperium. Other advocates of imperialism include Sir Oswald Mosley, Jean Thiriard, and Guillaume Fay. The division between imperialists and ethno-nationalists is often overlooked. Both ethno-nationalists and imperialists largely agree on what we dislike, and every day our enemies deliver fresh outrages to occupy our attention. By contrast, creating white ethno-states, or a unified white imperium, will only happen in the future. Why quarrel about long-term differences when we can focus on shared concerns in the present? There's also a muddle-headedness about the imperialist position that makes it easy to ignore. I have lost count of the times I have heard the imperialist argument put forward and then taken back at the last moment by saying we need an imperium, or maybe a federation, or maybe an alliance. As if there is no essential difference between a single white state and a group of white states in a federation or an alliance. There are plenty of differences between white advocates that are best set aside for the common good of the race, such as Christians versus pagans, pro-abortion versus anti-abortion, or capitalists versus socialists. There have been healthy white societies on both sides of such questions, so white nationalists are not forced to choose between them. Different white homelands could take different positions on these issues. But we have to deal with the question of imperialism versus ethno-nationalism. The two options are mutually exclusive. If there is only one white state, there can't be many. So we have to choose. Why can't we be simply pro-white? Because if we are serious about pro-white politics, we have to give that a concrete meaning, and that means answering the question of one state or many. Moreover, since this is a question about our ultimate goals, It is about the essence of our movement. What makes us a movement rather than a gaggle of fellow travelers is having a common political goal. Fellow travelers have different ultimate goals, but find themselves temporarily on the same path. They might share common complaints and enemies. They may be allies and companions for the time being, but because they have different destinations, they will eventually arrive at a fork in the road where they will have to shake hands and part ways. The freshest statement of the imperialist position is in Gregory Hood's recent American Renaissance speech, The Challenge Ahead. Quote, "What I want is a united Western civilization state that will ensure the physical survival of our race." A, quote, civilization state, unquote, is a new geopolitical term for an empire that defines itself in opposition to Western liberal democracy. Putin's Russia and Xi's China are the preeminent examples. Both are empires encompassing many nations under the cultural and political hegemony of a founding people, the Russians and the Han Chinese. A white civilization state would presumably follow the same pattern, an empire embracing many peoples under the political and cultural domination of a founding people. I usually agree with Greg Hood, but not in this case. I don't want a single white state for the reasons Wilmot Robertson sets forth in The Ethno-State. Ethno-nationalism promotes peace and diversity, political, cultural, and genetic, whereas imperialism imperils peace and diversity. A single white state will not emerge without conflict. Such a struggle is the last thing that a race demographically collapsing towards extinction needs. This prospect is especially horrifying given the prime candidates for Herrenvolk: Germans, Russians, and Americans. These nations might have the power to establish and dominate a white imperium, but culturally and spiritually, they are amongst the most degenerate. Increasing their power would make almost every European nation worse off rather than better. Hood claims that the imperium he envisions would respect, quote-unquote, local cultures. But this is hardly reassuring, given the record of empires past and present. Nor is it reassuring when Hood remarks that, quote, "We have been one people before in the relatively new phenomena of national identity, and Christian denominational differences divided us," end quote. When imperialists say national identities are relatively new, it is like leftists saying they are social constructs. They are slated for destruction. Moreover, the lost unity that Hood mourns didn't always exist. Yes, much of Europe was basically one people after Rome homogenized it. Yes, much of Europe was also Roman Catholic after the church destroyed all of its rivals. So much for respecting local cultures. There are four principal arguments for imperialism. First, only a unified white state can secure a future for the white race. Second, nation-states and national identities are obsolete in an increasingly globalized world. Third, we are attacked as whites, so we must defend ourselves as whites. More specific ethnic and national identities don't matter. Fourth, empires are glorious. Just think of Rome, Napoleon, Warhammer 40,000. Let's look at how Hood reprises the classic imperialist tropes. He touches on the first three arguments in a single paragraph. Quote, "National identities themselves are relatively recent creations. They are fading with travel, technology, and geopolitical arrangements that are breaking down the nation-state. The multipolar world that is emerging is a battle between civilizations. What unites a white person in America, England, France, Germany, Italy, the Netherlands, South Africa, Australia, and every other place is stronger than what unites him to those of different races who carry the same passport." As the world becomes more connected technologically, race isn't fading. It's becoming more important. And it's our opponents who insist it is central to every social interaction. We didn't ask for this. We are only playing the cards we were dealt. End quote. The first argument for imperialism is that small states are weaker than large states. Therefore, to protect themselves from large non-white powers like China, small white states must amalgamate into a single white empire. As Hood puts it, quote, this is not a dream, it is a necessity. Whites are a hated, shrinking global minority. We need a geopolitical lifeboat capable of ensuring our physical existence. Our choice is literally join or die. End quote. Whites should definitely be concerned with geopolitical competition from other races and civilizations, but at best, this is an argument for shifting military alliances or a more permanent treaty organization like NATO. It falls far short of an argument for a single white state. There is simply no power on earth that requires the political unification of all white nations to resist it. Beyond that, wars and other geopolitical crises are by their very nature interruptions in the normal order of things. They are temporary and fluid. It is foolish to institute permanent and fixed solutions to preempt temporary and fluid problems. Why would any nation permanently surrender its sovereignty to a superstate because of the possibility that it might lose its sovereignty in a war with China? After all, surrendering sovereignty entails dangers too. If a nation state surrenders its sovereignty to a superstate, that virtually guarantees that alien peoples will have far more power to determine its destiny. Again, to avoid the mere possibility of domination by still more alien peoples. This increases the chance that one's culture will be homogenized and one's population and resources will be stripped by the imperial capital. One will also risk being dragged into unnecessary wars. Another problem with a superstate is that it puts all our eggs in one basket. If the future of the white race depends on the decisions of a single government, what happens if that government goes catastrophically wrong? Obviously, that would imperil the whole race. In such a situation, Hood's geopolitical lifeboat would be more like a geopolitical Titanic, right down to the hubris, and individual nation-states would be the true lifeboats. Imperialists, however, argue that nation-states are fading away due to globalization. They will certainly disappear if nothing is done to stop globalization. But this is an argument for resisting globalization, not going along with it. Francis Parker Yockey poured scorn on tiny, quote, comic opera states. He equated national sovereignty simply with power, which means only very large states have sovereignty. Of course, since even the largest state can be destroyed if the rest of the world allies against it, that means that no nations have sovereignty, which is a reductio ad absurdum of equating sovereignty and power. Yockey simply can't explain why some of the statelets he mocks, like Liechtenstein and Monaco, are among the oldest and most prosperous sovereign entities on the planet, even though they're also among the weakest. But life isn't constant war. Sovereignty is not power. It is a moral norm. In international law, a sovereign state is the equivalent of a moral person, namely, someone who bears rights. Sovereign states are masters of their own internal affairs. No matter their size, they are considered to be equal under international law. To say that small nations have no sovereignty is as incoherent as saying that weak people have no rights. Rights don't make you bulletproof, but they do provide guidelines of proper behavior. Strong nations might invade weak nations, but the idea of sovereignty means they are wrong to do so, and other nations are right to join together to resist them. Sovereign nations are not in a state of perpetual war, because moral norms matter, even to politicians. The idea of sovereignty is as old as political thought, but the modern concept of sovereignty was created in the 17th century to bring an end to the religious wars by, in effect, disempowering the Pope to meddle in the internal religious affairs of nations. Its purpose was to promote peace by guaranteeing the right to differ. Despite globalist clichés about the inevitable decline of the nation-state, it is still the foundation of global political order. Nation-states make war and peace. They educate their citizens. They regulate the media. They open and close borders. They regulate economic activity. They can bring oligarchs to heel. They control virtually all the institutions and incentives necessary to preserve or destroy their populations. The various globalist treaty organizations, customs unions, and alliances like NATO, the European Union, and the United Nations are based upon agreements among sovereign nation states. They would evaporate overnight if enough nation states walked away from them. If white advocates are serious about saving our race, we need to challenge the current establishment at all levels, the higher the better, with the Holy Grail being control of sovereign states, which can say no to subsidiary powers, fellow sovereign states, and globalist entities. With enough sovereign states on our side, we can turn the world around. Imperialists also argue that nation-states are increasingly irrelevant because national identities are fading away. But this is simply another argument for resisting globalization rather than giving in to it. Beyond that, cultural homogenization is largely superficial. Yes, Europeans increasingly consume the same goods, but there will always be different European peoples because national identity is passed along with one's mother tongue. English may be today's lingua franca, but that's nothing new. In the past, it was French or Latin. But English will not be adopted by everyone, and it will remain a second or third language to most of those who learn it. Hood argues that racial identity will eclipse national identity simply because whites are being attacked as a race and replaced as a race. Quote, "Our fate will be decided as whites. Thus, we must act as whites. It will not be as members of different nations." End quote. But this does not follow. Yes, we are being attacked as a race. Therefore, we need to fight back on the racial front. When you're attacked, your enemy gets to choose where and how he attacks you, and you have to respond in kind. But just because our enemies see us as nothing but whites, that doesn't mean they are right. There is more to our identity than just race. Language, culture, and ethnicity also matter. Hood, however, seems to allow our enemies to define us. Quote, "Being white is the most meaningful identity we have. Our rulers gave us a negative one. We need a positive one." End quote. Because of this, Hood argues that, quote, "We are a people, not simply a group of peoples," end quote, "and one people needs one state." But whites are a race, not a people, because peoplehood presupposes a common language and culture, whereas whites have many different languages and cultures, alongside a common genetic and cultural heritage. White nationalism, therefore, cannot mean one white state for one white people. Instead, it can only mean national self-determination for all white peoples. Hood likens his dream to the Roman Empire, which he thinks was glorious. I confess, it leaves me cold. The Roman Empire left magnificent ruins, but it was a catastrophe to the peoples it conquered. Julius Caesar alone killed more than 1 million Gauls, at a time when one had to look one's victims in the eye. To add France to the Roman Empire. No white empire has ever been created without spilling oceans of white blood on all sides. For a dying race, this is sheer madness. Thus, it is a fair question. How many millions of Europeans are today's imperialists willing to kill to create their dream? Hood makes it very clear that we can't just defer debating imperialism versus ethno-nationalism forever. One's answer will define the essence of our movement and determine the meaning of everything we do today. Quote, there are more white advocates than ever, all looking for something to do, all pushing in a million different directions. We must have a final goal that gives us a common direction, even if we disagree on tactics, ideology, or organizational missions. The Western Imperium, the sacral empire that would unite and protect the white race, is that final goal. Of course, one danger of insisting that all white advocates pursue the same goal is that fewer people will get involved. But this is a debate that we cannot avoid. Moreover, if one chooses imperialism, we will not be able to defer all the other divisive questions either. For if there is only one white state, there can only be one answer to such questions as capitalism versus socialism. Another reason we can't defer the imperialism versus ethno-nationalism question is that one's attitudes on this matter influence one's present-day political stances. Although imperialists often present themselves as utopian dreamers, they're often apologists for quite grubby contemporary power agglomerations, as long as they're opposed to ethno-nationalism. For instance, right before abandoning the right altogether, Richard Spencer was a well-known standard-bearer for imperialism. From 2013 on, Spencer favored Russian imperialism over Ukrainian nationalism, the United Kingdom over independent Scotland, the European Union over an independent United Kingdom, and Spain over an independent Catalonia. It was certainly consistent, but what did it have to do with white advocacy? Currently, the white race is facing extinction through low fertility, miscegenation, and replacement migration imposed by the existing political establishment, which exercises power through both national and transnational institutions. To save ourselves, we need to replace the establishment before it replaces us. That means that we need power, which means we need to contest power at all levels. But Spencer's imperialism led him to denigrate even explicitly pro-white ethno-nationalist movements as, quote, petty, while defending anti-white imperial agglomerations simply because they are larger and more powerful. This makes no sense if one's primary concern is white survival. Indeed, it only makes sense if one is primarily a power worshipper, which is what Spencer turned out to be. This is why he left the dissident right altogether. He followed the power. Hood's imperialism also leads to incoherence in the face of present-day politics. Quote, what is to be done? We will build tribes, churches, networks. We will turn our backs on their world and build our own. We will build political power locally and wield it where we can. And we will build towards the dream of a Western Imperium that is our destiny, that will bind our people together in unity, honor, and strength. End quote. Hood counsels us here to think both very big and very small. Quote, building strength locally is a first step, and it allows for political action. End quote. This is true. But if one can organize locally, why not regionally and nationally as well? How can one get from the local to the universal without passing through the nation state? Hood clearly thinks that demographic change is too advanced in the United States for a pro-white force to gain political power. The proper lesson for Americans is to give up on democracy, not America. But in most white countries, it is still possible for pro-white forces to vie for national power. Why pass up the chance? Why seek power only on the local level, which can be annulled on the national level, but not seek national power within existing sovereign states? Because this is the logic of the imperialist dream. Our fate will be decided as whites. Thus, we must act as whites. It will not be as members of different nations. End quote. To believe in the imperium commits one to the idea that there's no point in contesting power in nation states, even though that is where actual sovereignty resides. This is simply self-defeating. In sum, I advocate ethno-nationalism because I believe that it promotes peace and diversity by giving distinct peoples their own sovereign homelands. I oppose imperialism because it increases conflict and decreases diversity. Moreover, I have explained why I don't find the arguments for preferring imperialism to ethno-nationalism convincing. Finally, ethno-nationalism is politically realistic because it can build upon existing political movements and existing sovereign states, whereas imperialism offers high-minded rhetoric but no concrete path to white survival. The debate between imperialists and ethno-nationalists cannot be avoided because it concerns the very essence of our movement. Indeed, are we one movement or two? Nor can the debate be postponed, because one's answer has concrete implications for the movement today. I look forward to continuing the conversation. And that is the end of his article. All right. So, let's get some of your thoughts here in the chat, and then I will also take a look at the super chat on Entropy, see if anything's there. Now, to the extent that I've been talking about this issue for the past few months, several months really, is slightly different to Greg Johnson's, some of Greg Johnson's more precise ideas there and some of his statements there. Because I would actually even support breaking away from the nation state via secession movements, separatist movements, independence movements, such as the ones that exist in Scotland, Catalonia, erstwhile independence movements that existed in Northern Italy. Although there is one that still is holding out in Sud Tirol, South Tirol, the Germanic, German-speaking parts of Northern Italy that used to belong to Austria. And in fact, this is where things, these independence movements or these separatist movements, you know, they're not very appealing. I understand that. Because they're all lousy with leftists and Antifa types. And in the case of Scotland, for example, they want to get independence from the UK and then run directly to the European Union. In the case of Sud Tirol, they want to break away from Italy and run directly into the arms of Austria. So they don't really want independence. They just want, in many cases, they're motivated by spite, by resentment. The Scottish, they're so far to the left. They're so, global homo compared to the quite global homo nation of the English. But they want to be independent so they can look down on the racist little Englanders and be an open borders country, a sanctuary state for refugees, and a member of the Holy European Union. So I get that many of the separatist movements that exist today are not very appealing. But that's where I think nationalist right-wingers have been missing opportunities. The fact that only the left exists in this political space, on this political stage, is because the right has never taken this seriously. As Greg Johnson's essay mentioned, men like Yaki and Mosley were calling nations petty in their day. And they were arguing for this, unification, this united European imperium, civilization state, as Greg Hood is now putting it. And so that has been the right wing, I suppose you could call it, to use that term, right and left. What does it mean nowadays? But anyway, that was the sort of, the nationalist stance. And I think it's wrong. I think Greg Johnson lays out very many good reasons as to why it's wrong-headed. I understand, in particular, Mosley's perspective. If I put myself in his shoes in that time, I understand when you have the threat of the Red Terror, the Bolsheviks on one side, and the Americans on the other, you need to become something big and strong enough to fight them back. And yeah, I think the United Kingdom, England should have allied with Germany, and the French, the Vichy government, to oppose the Reds and the Yanks. To be honest, it would have been that way instead of doing what, we all know happened. So he was right in that moment. But then again, that's what Greg Johnson says. Wars are temporary and fluid. They require temporary solutions. They require fluid solutions, fluid positions. But they are abnormal. Especially world wars aren't the norm. Knock on wood. And so in normal times, I don't think that, what we need is a unified white super state. I think unification is a false god. And again, Greg makes the excellent point that disparate, independent, sovereign white nations, European nations, and if you want to use the term white, that's fine. I'm just going to keep using European because I don't often use the term white anyway. There's no reason why independent, sovereign European nations can't form alliances or federations or blocs. Not very long ago, less than 5 years ago, my hope was that the Italy of Lega and Salvini would form a bloc with the Visegrad Four nations, the Czech Republic, Hungary, Poland, and Austria. That was my hope. And people in the halls of power, people in the know, people with influence were talking in no longer hushed tones about that possibility. I distinctly remember this was spoken about realistically, that these countries were going to form an alliance, a bloc within the EU that could then later be used to totally dismantle the EU, because as Greg Johnson says in his essay, once enough nation states walk away from these globalist institutions, they will no longer exist, or they at least they will certainly not wield the power they have over us that they have now. But of course, we all know what happened. The Italian coalition government between Five Star and Lega was pathetic and full of treachery. Salvini was ousted through a manufactured scandal involving the detention of NGO migrant boats. He was actually accused of kidnapping. Yeah, he was accused of kidnapping by not allowing foreign NGO boats to unload their human cargo in Italy. And so it all kind of, fell apart. I believe even that young so-called nationalist leader in Austria, he ended up getting ousted recently as well. And then, of course, the Poles, the Hungarians, they're kind of hanging on by a thread. Because the European Union keeps trying to subvert their governments, bribe their governments, punish their governments, their countries through sanctions and all that sort of stuff, precisely because these nations want to remain sovereign, make their own decisions, and in particular, make decisions about who comes into their country, from where, and in what quantity. And so Greg Johnson talks a lot of, in his essay about the nation state and nation states and vying for sovereignty within the nation state structure. And that's fine. Those are good points, especially in comparison to the idea of imperialism, of an Aryan super state or something like that is often said. Whereas my only difference in Greg's position there is that I believe that we could even look for independence, not just from these globalist institutions, but even from the nation states themselves. We could even start to advocate for divorce, separatist movements, independence movements, inject a nationalist right-wing perspective into this area, this political stage, and not just let it be the territory of, the SNP and, Antifa-ridden Catalan nationalist movements and things like that. So those are kind of my overall thoughts. And I also like how Greg Johnson said that his position is more realistic than the imperialist position, because this is something that I've come across in my on the occasions where I have voiced my opinion on this, my position on this, is that people will say, no, you're too idealistic. The world you want is this sort of medieval map where Europe is comprised of many small nation states, as if it was, the Europe of the 15th century, and there's all these little provinces and city-states and principalities, et cetera, et cetera. I believe radical liberation calls medieval anarchy or something like that. He's also on my side of things on this issue. And so people, the naysayers will say, you're idealistically yearning for a return to, a medieval times type world. And I do think it is idealistic. Sure, I don't mind that accusation, but I don't think it's not realistic. And in fact, I think my position, Radler's position, and Greg Johnson's position, and our ambition is more realistic than this idea that white people, that people of European ethnicities, of nations, are going to come together at this time, at this stage in our timeline. We're going to come together and form this white imperium. First of all, we have a boot on our neck. So before we can even think about grandiose ideas of a white imperium, we have to get off the ground and get this boot off our neck. And then also, I just don't think that it strikes me that it's often Americans who want this white imperium, which is why it was pleasantly refreshing to see an American respond to them, object to them, counter them. Because I don't think Americans understand just how different Europeans are. Even within their own countries, it was difficult enough just getting, a country like Italy or Spain to unite, again, under this false god of unification, into these barely held together nation states that are, in the case of Italy, Masonic creations, really. And so this idea, that the French and the Italians and the English were all going to just willingly join into this, white imperium defined by, racial identity instead of, nationalist or even regionalist identities. I just don't think it's gonna happen. And that's good, because I don't want that. And again, to the extent that it is realistic, the imperialist position is realistic, I think we already see how it plays out. The European Union is basically the realization of the imperialist vision. It just happens to be in the wrong hands, which is, again, something that Greg Johnson said. What happens when the white superstate is, you know, catastrophic, is led by people who, you know, turn it into a catastrophe. I think that's what's happened. We don't have to, you know, have hypotheticals about it. That's what's happened. The League of Nations, the European Union, the United Nations, the World Health Organization, all of these, you know, are in the hands of people who despise us. And I've seen people saying that, you know, well, we could reform the EU, or we could take over the EU. That's not going to happen. They're not, the whole, the European Union was from the beginning designed to be anti-nationalist. They're not going to let anyone like us get involved in and have any sort of influence in the corridors of power there. Okay, Reed Johnson has a question here. What should define the legitimacy of a separatist movement? Should it start with the majority will of a people or a region? Because each potential separatist territory can have its own internal tension between leaving and staying. Yes, as is the case in Catalonia, as is the case in Scotland, as is the case in the United Kingdom when we had Brexit. This is why I think, this is why I've been talking about this for such a long time. This is why I'm so happy that Greg Johnson wrote that essay. And also, just one moment, Gadius asks if I'll be taking call-ins. Yeah, we can do call-ins towards the end of the show. We can have some time reserved for call-ins, definitely. Back to Reed's question. This is why I've been talking about it, because I think we are going to have this internal tension first. The right needs to get involved in this conversation, needs to enter the stage and have some sort of presence here and see the validity and the potential in separatist movements, in independence movements, in secession movements, and not just in Europe. I think this is also the salvation for whites in America. I think, you know, that's why it's so funny to me. Gadius has this message here saying, all the Empire Spurgs migrated to the New World, lol. It's in our genes, man. Could be the case. It could be the case that I don't disagree. But then for me, it's such a bitter irony, because I think, you know, that whilst the Americans are yearning for, you know, white Imperium 40K, Warhammer 40K style, or, you know, something grandiose like that, I think that actually the path to their survival and their well-being is in the breakup of the United States, is in secession in the United States, is in the United States basically going the way of the Soviet Union, going the way of the Roman Empire, collapsing, breaking apart, and it's going to be hard, it's going to be dangerous, it's going to be probably very tedious and tiresome as well, mostly that, probably. But then through that process of breaking up, collapse, separation, white Americans might find themselves with the potential to make an Oriana, like in South Africa. Just to start, right? Just to start. But then build from that and start creating independent white ethnostates in what used to be the United States. I do think this will cause internal tension. What should define the legitimacy of a separatist movement? In my opinion, I base the legitimacy of it on the pillars of Herodotus. My claim is this: a nation must be a people, not a passport, not a territory defined by arbitrary lines on a map. A nation is a people. And that people, in order to be a nation, has to have shared blood. It has to be kin. It has to be family. Shared customs and shared language. The religion part, I'll leave out, was more important in Herodotus's time. What we have now are fake nations, anti-nations, where none of those things exist anymore. Shared blood? Look at the United States and tell me that that's a nation with shared blood. Look at what's going on in the United Kingdom. 1 million foreigners imported in 1 year alone. Most of them coming from North Africa and the Middle East and Sub-Saharan Africa. That's not shared blood. Shared customs? Neither of that as well. Shared language? No. That's, look at what's going on. And there's parts of the United Kingdom where they're not speaking English. Look at the United States. I can't imagine, how many different languages now are spoken in these sort of areas. I know that obviously because of the South American influx, Spanish is now, that was happening ever since I was a child. The prevalence of Spanish on, road signs. Everything was written in English, and then on the back, also in Spanish, or just below in Spanish. So that's been happening for decades. And I can only imagine it's gotten worse. So this is for me what defines legitimacy is that, and this is also why I'm sympathetic to Scottish nationalism, Welsh nationalism, Catalan nationalism, Basque nationalism, because these people, particularly like the Basques, they are. The Basques are ethnically different from the rest of Spain, from the rest of the Iberian Peninsula, to the extent that anthropologists are still quite bemused as to where exactly they come from. And their language is also very different. The Catalan people, again, a different language. And it's, again, this is, I think, something that the Americans might not fully understand, the intensity of the language issue. Whenever a Catalan independence flares up and there's tension or there's scuffles or whatever, or there's scandal, it's often because a Catalan refused to speak Spanish on a television program or in a school. They were teaching the classes in Catalan, and so parents who moved to Catalonia from Andalusia or something. They start protesting, saying, "Well, our children don't speak Catalan. The classes should be done in Castellano." And then the Catalan response is, "But you're not in Spain anymore. You're in Catalonia. We speak Catalan here." Like the language issue is so intense. And just look at history. Look at how the English always understood this. That's why they tried to exterminate, literally make extinct, the Gaelic languages of the Welsh and the Irish. Talking about that Welsh song that we had leading in today, that language is on its knees because the English really took a hammer to it. They did not want people speaking their native tongue, which is so important. And why did they not want that? Because the linguistic difference keeps them united. It reminds them who they are as a people distinct from the Anglo-Saxons, as a people of a nation. With a nation. That you can't have that sentiment if you're trying to, rule over them. So, yeah, for me, it's the pillars of Herodotus. That for me is what I base my claim on, is that I want a nation built on these four things. And again, the religion thing, well, I suppose, with the influx of Islam, I suppose the religion thing does matter. And I'm sure it does matter a hell of a lot to Catholics and Christians. So yeah, I suppose the religion issue still matters even to this day. Gadius says, hypothetical, all white nations become explicitly pro-white. Ethno-nationalism replaces neoliberalism, etc. All of them except one, let's say, Italy. Italy has decided to go gentle into the good night. And it's not worth the trouble to try and save their aging population. They'll just import North Africans as caretakers until they're basically replaced. Call it Hannibal's revenge. This is the will of the Italians, not subversives or Jews. My question, or questions, do the other white nations intervene? Wouldn't this be a good example of when an imperium or a superstate is needed, even to protect Italians from their own sovereign decisions? That situation, it would be as an Italian, it would be a dreadful situation. And it could indeed be the will of the Italians, you know. That will of theirs, I believe, has been placed in their brains like a bacteria. I don't think, you know, the idea was originally no people of their own will wants to be replaced or, you know, die off. I think this is the first time in human history that we have this phenomena. But it's because people have been so brainwashed into utter madness. But there are people who are brainwashed that way, and we can't help them. We can't save them, despite all of our best efforts. They're not going to change their minds or see the error of their way. So, yeah, and there is a future scenario where a frightening majority of people will willingly want this without questioning it and without seeing how horrible it is. And it could even be in a country like Italy. And this is why I don't want the, you know, the super state. I don't want, you know, transnational, supranational organizations, because just imagine, this is now getting very hypothetical. Imagine if Italy was like the biggest swinging dick in Europe. It's so ridiculous to say that because Italy is part of pigs, you know, they're not anywhere near the level of power of France or Germany. But just imagine if they had the kind of power and influence that a country like France or Germany has in Europe. And then they could start, you know, through soft politics, soft power, or even through hard power, you know, start mandating that all the other countries have to toe the line as well. No, we're all getting involved in this. We're all going to do this, you know, suicide pact. So even though it would be, you know, a disaster and a tragedy if a country like Italy took those decisions, this is why I think I want separate nations, separate sovereign nations, so that if there is some, you know, retarded country off in the, you know, in the back corner of the class, the rest of the class doesn't have to be held back and punished because of that student's actions. They can make their own decisions, and they can separate themselves from the madness. And then again, like, how would the Imperium intervene? Like, you know, would, I suppose then, let's say Paris is the capital, France is the, you know, the hub of the White Imperium in Europe. You know, it's centrally located on the European continent. It's economically strong. So would France send the navy, the French navy, and then all the other, you know, other European countries' navies to sort of blockade the Mediterranean and block off Italy, and then ground troops would have to go into the Italian mainland to make sure that, you know, Italy does as the Imperium commands? I mean, again, there's going to be conflict in this. Whereas I think if nations were separate and independent and had their own sovereignty, and I do like Yaki's definition of sovereignty. Sovereignty means being held accountable to no one. So I'll give Yaki credit for that very good definition. If all the other European nations were sovereign and separate and making their own decisions for their own well-being based on an ethnocentric basis, then they could, you know, just say, look, Italy's doing that thing and we don't agree and we're not going to participate. It's a tragedy, but we can't do anything about it, but we are going to look after ourselves. And ultimately, just as in one's individual life, that's really all we can do is look after what's in our own hands to look after. So it's an interesting hypothetical situation. It certainly would, I think, provoke conflict and tragedy either way. But I don't think it necessitates an imperium. So I hope that you guys enjoyed the reading of that article, because going forward into 2023, I think that this is going to be the format of these streams. I think what I have in mind is a lot more storytelling, but not just stories of, like, you know, traditional festivals like the running of the bulls or Il Palio that I've been to, or anecdotes of living in the countryside of France. Instead, I had the thought of doing some live readings. So, for example, tonight was Greg Johnson's essay, but I also had the idea of, for example, reading books live on these streams, a few chapters, a few passages a night. So, for example, Mine Were of Trouble by Peter Kemp is something that I had in mind that could be interesting to read together. That is an account of the Spanish Civil War told from a Francoist perspective. Peter Kemp went to go fight on the side of the Francoists. I think many of you are familiar with George Orwell's account, Homage to Catalonia. And he fought on the communist side, the Republican side. So I think it would be interesting to read the perspective of someone who I think we are much more in agreement with, even though Orwell, to his credit, saw the error of his ways and quite, his life literally depended on getting breaking away from the crazy commies. Another idea I had was to read some selections from Imperium Press's traditional, what's the name of the book? Traditional Folk Tales in the Indo-European Tradition, or Folk Tales in the Indo-European Tradition, something like that. It's a book full of old folk tales, Germanic, Celtic, Italic. Many of them are very short. So we could just read a few of those, because that's kind of, what I want these streams to be about. It's just maintaining our culture, our traditions, being very cozy, telling stories together, not so much getting into the weeds of, daily politics and things like that. So if that's something that interests you happy few who listen to these streams. Just let me know your thoughts, because that is something that I've been thinking about for this year. If not, this stream would just be like any other else, just going over the daily grind, the daily nonsense, 2 minutes hate, that sort of thing, which we all do it. We all have to do the necessary slog of modern life, but I think that there's a risk of just too much, too much of an overload. And I'd like to offer something a bit different, maybe a bit more uplifting. And then again, even educational, if we start to read things like, Peter Kemp's, memoir of fighting in the Spanish Civil War, things like that. Because one of the most well-received streams I did was the one where I read that chapter from Our God Is Your God Too, But He Has Chosen Us, the chapter on Zionist anti-Semitism. That was one of the most well-received, and it was just me reading a chapter from a book by Laurent Guillaumeau. So since it was so well-received, I thought, what, maybe just reading some essays, some articles, even some fiction would be a good idea. All right. Yeah, it looks like we had some positive feedback to the idea. Tom says, great foot to start 2023 on, a commitment to something positive and mind-opening. I support the idea. Well, thank you. All right. Gadius asked if I was going to take some calls. So, unless anyone's going to be posting some more, well, you guys can keep posting comments and stuff in the chat. But yeah, I'll open the phone lines, as it were, if anyone wants to call in. And I'll unmute Gadius right now. All right, Gadius, you're muted.
What do you say, Pox? How's it going, man? How's the new year treating you?
Not too bad. Very, very laid back. I'm happy that one of my buddies from an old Muay Thai gym that I used to go to, He opened his own Muay Thai gym the first of the month. And it's great. I've gone back to training Muay Thai this month. Because I left the gym that he and I were both going to because the owner reinstated mask mandates when there was the Omicron outbreak. And I was just like, F this, man. I'm not training Muay Thai while wearing a fucking mask. Get over yourself. Get over your fear. And I never went back because it was just kind of too awkward to go back. So this guy, he's decided to go on his own and open his own little dojo. And so it's been a nice positive development for the year. How about you?
Not too shabby. Can't complain. I wanted to follow up on the Imperium thing, like the topic of your stream today. With regards to Hood's civilization state thing, he's been talking about it for a couple years now, at least as far back as I can remember since I've been following his stuff. I'd say like the most charitable view you could give to it is it's like an idea, it's like a self-defense strategy, right? Because like the grandiose Imperium talk, like Imperial, you know, we've got to conquer again. It's to try and motivate, like, you know, a passive and different population of Europeans. Like, we need something to strive for, something grand, something, you know, we need glory again or something like that. So I think, like, that's, like, the most charitable way to interpret it. Maybe, like, I'm not for Imperium at all. Like, you know, I'm fucking American, you know, I'm like a small government, you know, like I have like traditional conservatard roots or whatever, but like,
there's nothing wrong,
you know, like,
that.
like federalism and all that shit. But, what I mean is like, maybe he's thinking of something, you know, sort of like a defensive block, like, you know, like a realm, like the European realm, you know, like, at least Europe, obviously mainland Europe, like should totally be off limits to like outsiders whatsoever, you know, like any outsiders whatsoever. So maybe like that's, I mean, I don't want to speak for the guy, but just trying to like interpret it as charitable as possible. Cause we see what's going on, the great replacement's happening, all these, you know, everybody's just hordes and hordes of people flooding into Europe. And it's like, we got to do something about it. And if we're going to go for it, we might as well, you know, go big, have this big grandiose, like vision of like, you know, reconquista or whatever, you know, basically flexing on the entire world or whatever. So I don't know. I just figured that's a, you know, that's a charitable version. I don't know. What do you think about that?
Well, to be honest, I don't fail to understand where the Imperium side is coming from. It's an understandable position, especially given the scale of what's going on. You know, yes, hordes of foreigners are coming into Europe, non-Europeans, especially, you know, from the sub-Saharan Africa continent, North Africa, Middle East. It's also happening in the United States. It's been happening for a long time. You know, you get these nowadays, the new thing is these caravans coming up through Latin America, and they're not just caravans full of, you know, Latin Americans. There's Haitians in them. There's sub-Saharan Africans in them. There's Indians and Pakistanis in them. It's like people from all over the world are getting placed into these caravans and then ferried to the southern United States border. Like the scale is massive. And so I understand that, you know, for some people, the response is, well, we have to do something just as massive in scale to defend ourselves from this. And I think Greg Johnson was right in saying, you know, to resist globalization shouldn't mean to give in to it. And so I think the overall, the arc of history, especially, you know, since the early 1900s, especially since the Second World War, has been, you know, these macro scale states, these super states, globalization, global governance, global homogeneity, you know, and also because of, you know, the prevalence of post-industrial technology, media technology, the internet, another massive development in this, you know, things have gotten very global and homogenized and macro, huge in scale. And so I understand, you know, that people would say, look, the reaction to this, the defense of this needs to be something big too. But for me, when I look at this, first of all, what you mentioned about, you know, Europeans need something to believe in again, a cause, a glorious ambition. Well, for me, I can't think of anything more ambitious and more glorious than using our bare hands and taking back power from these supranational institutions that hate us and these nation states that hate us and breaking away from them and forming ethnocentric states, nations, based on the pillars of Herodotus, based on his definition, and being accountable to no one and apologizing to no one for doing so. I think that could be, you know, a very Faustian quest, a very glorious quest. It just depends on, you know, your perspective on these issues. For some people, you know, we should be colonizing Mars, apparently, for a glorious quest. But I want to live in the real world, and I don't care about space colonization. I just don't care what's out there. So, yeah, that for me would be like the glorious quest, you know, getting independence, just as if you were, you know, an Irishman in 1916, you know, that was a glorious fight for independence. Was it very big in scale? No, not really. It was a local fight for your local people. But it was certainly epic and glorious for the Irishman involved in it. And then what was the other thing you said about, is it, it was a self-defense. I can understand that.
Like a self-defense strategy. Like
what was the other thing you said?
Yeah. Like the way I envision it is like, you got NATO, right? And it's like, NATO taken to its like logical conclusion would be like America gets out and it's just, you know, like a European defensive alliance or whatever. And that basically sets up like a defensive block, like a realm. And like, that would be what, you know, a charitable view of Imperium would be, in my opinion.
Again, I don't see why independent ethnocentric nation states can't form blocks and alliances and work together for mutual aims. Although Yaki would say that whenever you have an alliance, there's never anything mutual. It's always a larger power. The way he put it was, you know, within alliances, there's always the country who doesn't need the alliance and the country who does need the alliance. And so in Yaki's view, there's no such thing as a mutually, you know, amicable alliance. It's all power. It's all based on power. So maybe, you know, that's why these imperialist types can't envision a Europe of independent, ethnocentric nation states, small nation states, forming alliances to form that kind of realm and protective block that you speak of, because they don't believe in mutually beneficial alliances in the first place. They believe that within every alliance, there's always weaker countries who need the alliance and depend on it, and countries who just benefit from it, really, because it's convenient, but they don't need it because they, you know, they have more power. So yeah, that would be, I don't think Imperium is necessary for forming those protective barriers and that kind of protective realm. But if you take the idea that all politics is power play and all alliances are power plays, then again, I can understand why people would, you know, take that position.
Yeah, I think like territorial integrity would have to be off the table totally. Like, to sort of answer the hypothetical I put forth to you, I'd say that like North African immigration would be like people that live in like Portugal or Spain or the UK or like Sweden, they would have a claim over Italy's territory just vis-a-vis them being in the European continent. So like immigration into Italy by North Africans would not be tolerated by other European nations, even if Italy remained, you know, totally sovereign. But that would be, you know, off the table, like out of the question. You can't do that. That's part of everyone's heritage, like Italy, Rome, you know, everyone's fucking heritage in on the European continent. So that would be like the type of thing, like a, you know, transnational alliance or whatever. Like I would be amicable to. I mean, it's up to Europeans ultimately. Like their fate is up to them. But that's something I would think would, you know, be proper in a situation like that.
Yeah, the way I see that playing out in a hypothetical situation would be, and this might sound strange, because how can you deny the importance of, you know, all of the cultural treasures found within Italy? But I wouldn't be surprised if people in France, people in Germany, people in England, people in Portugal, you know, they said, okay, yeah, there's a lot of cultural treasure in Italy, but it's not us. It's not Portugal. It's not Portuguese cultural treasure. It's not French cultural treasure. I'm a Frenchman. If I want cultural treasures, you know, I have them in my own country. I don't really care about, you know, the ancient Roman ruins in Italy if they're, you know, getting lost to waves of African immigration. You know, at least it's not happening in my country. I guess I would say it's kind of like, imagine if, you know, imagine if the state of New York decided that it was going to still be global homo. And I'm sure there's cultural, you know, treasures and that sort of thing, you know, in New York City, and then also in the other parts of the state, you know, there's natural landscapes that are cherished as well in the state of New York. But let's say, you know, someone living in Nebraska, do you really think they would care if all the other states, you know, or in a world where in America, where, you know, white Americans are breaking away and forming Orianas, and states, whole entire states are breaking away, you know, seceding as if it was, you know, the 1850s again, and other states are joining them, and they're forming, you know, alliances against the American Empire, whatever you want to call it. Do you think someone in Nebraska would really care if the New Yorkers still want to go along with, you know, miscegenation, replacement immigration, cultural degeneracy and all that kind of thing? Or do you think the guys in Nebraska would just be like, yeah, but we're fine. We saved ourselves, you know? That's kind of how I would see it playing out in a more European setting. It'd be kind of like that.
Yeah, there's already like historical precedent for it. If you think about it, I mean, mm-hmm. Turkey owns all of East Thrace, you know, and to me, yeah. Like, I mean, I'm an American, but that's Europe. Anything west of the Bosphorus is Europe. And you know, quite frankly, coastal Anatolia is technically Europe, in my opinion, because that's where Thales is from, you know, like the first guy of Greek philosophy or whatever. But like, yeah, I mean, there's already been a precedent for it, and it's like, how much more would anyone be willing to give up? So, like, I think, like, you know, like I said earlier, I think it's just like, we got to put our foot down. Enough is enough, and we're gonna reconquer. And if we got to do it with empire, we're gonna do it. But like I said, I'm not an empire guy. I think empire's played out. There's no necessity for it anymore. I mean, you could give like a, you know, reason why empire was useful in the past. It was useful to like try to control the situation, you know, because nobody knew like what was going on over there, like out there. So like trying to control all the territory as humanly possible would like, you know, make sense. But now like we know we know where all the territory is. We know where all the natural resources are. We know where all the people are. So empires just, it doesn't make any sense unless we're talking about, like, you know, legit Warhammer shit, like invading like other planets or whatever. So, yeah.
Well, it's interesting, like, talking about Anatolia, and it is a bit heartbreaking. If you look at where the Aryans used to be, how far-flung and widespread our very ancient ancestors were, and what territory used to be theirs, and how much, you know, they and we, are their descendants, have lost over the eons. It's a shrinking map. It's a shrinking map. Despite the expansion into South America and North America and Australia, you know, the place where the Indo-Europeans or the Aryans, and the other peoples who form the ancestors of us, you know, they were far more expansive on the Eurasian continent. And now, we've been reduced to just, you know, from Portugal to, from Lisbon to, you know, St. Petersburg, basically. And Anatolia has been lost. And I do believe that if, you know, there was ever a grand Reconquista, it's time to reconquer Constantinople. It's time to make the Hagia Sophia a cathedral again. And I'm not even a Christian. I'm not even a Catholic. But it's time to take back what was European land and drive out these invaders. And it's also another annoyance of frustration. Of course, we're all familiar with the hypocrisy of our adversaries and that they don't care about being hypocrites. But, you know, we're always told to feel guilty of the expansioning, the expansionism, the conquering of our ancestors. Yet, you know, when are the Turks ever made to feel guilty for conquering Anatolia? When are the Turks ever made to feel guilty for invading Eastern and Mediterranean Europe and slaughtering millions and conquering all sorts of European territory? What about the Arabs and what they did in North Africa, conquering all of North Africa and making the indigenous people there, reducing them to a minority and, you know, totally consuming their territory and their homelands? They're never made to feel guilty about it, only us. And then as far as, you know, the thing about empire being, you know, sort of unnecessary nowadays, someone like Yaki would say that it's not a question of whether or not empire is necessary, it's that it's inevitable. And a lot of pro-imperialism guys will say this, that there will always be, power vacuums that get filled by super states, by empire, basically. Because they look at, you know, the cycles of history, or I think these people are more linear based in their view of history. So they look at the line of history, which isn't really something that I believe you should do, but anyway. And they'll say that, you know, there's always going to be an empire. So whether it's the Roman Empire, whether it's the Persian Empire, whether it's the Mongolians, whether it's the British, there's always going to be, politics and power is always going to be a clash of superpowers. United States versus Soviet Union, that sort of thing. And now if we're going to be in, you know, the multipolar world, these guys want to have a say. You know, they want Europe to be a bloc and white people to be a civilization state that has a say and isn't just letting China and Russia and, you know, I guess Brazil and India rule the roost. Now, my response to that is kind of autistic, esoteric stuff. I believe that the Age of Empires isn't just a computer game. There really was an Age of Empires. It was the Age of Ares. And in that age, that age was defined by Imperium, by particularly Aryans expanding, conquering, making war, being Giga Chads, and that defined the age of Aries. Then, you know, the thing is with that interpretation is that that also there's a, empires are also kind of just happening also beyond that age. So they even happen in the age of Pisces, which is, you know, what we've been in. Okay. But then we're supposed to be entering the age of Aquarius relatively soon enough. And the age of Aquarius is going to be defined supposedly by communication, cooperation. Now, this could all be bullshit, but it's also going to be defined by a new enlightenment, things like that. And that's why people believe that, you know, the whole transhumanism thing is part of this, and that's where AI comes in and things like that, and global telecommunications, and like I said, the arc of history seems to be going that direction. And so I wonder if in the age of Aquarius, just as the imperialists argue that, you know, nation states are antiquated concepts, I wonder if so too will the idea of empire become an antiquated concept. So we'll, you know, both sides will be left in the dustbin of history, in the dustbin of the age. I don't know. It's kind of getting into like esoteric astrological stuff there. But and so then ultimately, like, my position is like, you know, in the day to day, in the real world, my position is just, I don't want to give in to globalism to resist globalism. And I think that especially for the survival of, you know, the European ethnicities and, you know, in broader terms, the white race, I do think that the best way to resist globalism, global governance, homogeneity, and the slow genocide of our people, the soft genocide of our people, is to break away and get our sovereignty back, whatever means necessary, and form our own sovereign nation states, even if that means breaking away from the nation states that we currently exist in. So yeah, that's just kind of how I see it. But I do, it is a big issue, and that's why I was so, you know, happy to see Greg Johnson writing this article and expanding the audience of this debate so that more people can be exposed to it and start thinking about these questions. And that's also why I posted the question earlier. I asked, how often have you changed your mind regarding, you know, deeply held views? Because I do want to change people's minds on this. I do want people to entertain some ideas that they might not previously have entertained. And I think Greg is right that we can't delay this this question, this issue anymore, especially when you have things like the Russian-Ukrainian conflict. You know, I think that puts into sharp focus. What is your position? Are you an ethno-nationalist or are you an imperialist? And I think we see that the Russia-Ukraine conflict has definitely caused a division. A lot of the imperium types are going to be pro-Russian, and a lot of the ethno-nationalist types are going to be more on the Ukrainian side, despite all of the, you know, the shortcomings of both sides and the, you know, the very off-putting elements of both sides, you know. But where you stand on the issue of imperium or ethno-nationalism determines where you stand on the most important event of 2022, you know?
Yeah, it's a great debate to have. It's a lot better than, you know, debating like whatever current thing is going on, Andrew Tate or something stupid like that. God. But I asked Greg Hood on Twitter if he's going to respond to the essay, and he said yeah, he's going to. It might be in his book. He's supposed to be having a book come out this year. Nationalist Without a Nation or something like that. So it'll probably be in that. But yeah, this is definitely better to it's better to have a back and forth on with something actually interesting, you know, instead of, you know, all the other crap that's out there or whatever. But yeah, I don't know. I think the Empire thing, I think there's always going to be like somebody with the ring of power. There's always going to be a nation with the ring of power, yeah. Right? The big boy on the block, yeah. Like that's always going to be there, but it doesn't necessarily mean like we got to have a fucking empire, like a globe spanning empire or whatever, you know?
In this context, right? Italy, my country of my father's origin, or Ireland, my mother's, you know, on my mother's side, my country of origin, or the country I live in now, Spain. Like, none of these three countries are very important or powerful within the European Union, within geopolitics. But that doesn't mean they can't exist. That doesn't mean the Irish people, the Spanish people, the Italian people can't exist and can't have sovereignty in their own, you know, nation state. Just because they're not massive superpowers compared to China, Russia, or the United States doesn't mean that they can't exist, you know? I think that's a kind of a point that Greg Johnson makes as well in his essay.
And the thing about empire is too, like, you try to, you know, like Globohoma is going on or whatever, and you try to institute an empire with like standards or whatever, like everybody speaking a lingua franca or whatever, and it's like people naturally click up it. They're going to retribalize no matter what. You're always going to have, like, you could try to force everybody to be exactly the same under like one rule or whatever, and people are still going to gravitate to their own natural kinds. There's always going to be tribes.
Another reason, if I just may interrupt, this is another reason why I think my position, Greg Johnson's position, Radlib's position even, is actually more realistic, is historically, is based on history. Because, and again, all of this stuff might not happen in our lifetimes, but we should at least, you know, talk about it and set the stage for our generations to come, our progeny. Because historically, what does tend to happen when a big superpower, an empire, ultimately reaches its inevitable conclusion, its collapse? Small nations rise from the ashes, rise from the rubble. There is a retribalization. It happened when the Soviet Union fell. It happened when the Roman Empire fell. In the case of colonial powers, there's, you know, when the British Empire completely committed suicide in the Second World War, they could no longer, you know, maintain control over their far-flung colonies. So their far-flung colonies regained independence. And so, you know, again, this might happen 100 years down the line and we won't be around for it. But let's say, you know, the European Union does collapse. Let's say the United States, the American Empire, whatever you want to call it, let's say that collapses too, and there are secessionist movements and there are separatist movements in the United States and things like that. I think that that is realistic. That is a realistic scenario. You know, I do think that empires have an expiry date. I think the United States has an expiry date, but that doesn't necessarily mean a bad thing. I think that that means that, you know, states like, let's say, for example, the South, you know, the South might rise again. It might actually happen. Let's imagine, you know, a United States that has become so dysfunctional, it's too bloated, it's imploding under its own massive weight. And so now you get states to say, look, we want more autonomy. It starts with that. We want autonomy. We want to make our own decisions. We want more freedom to make our own decisions as Wisconsinites, as, I don't know, what do you call people who live in Nebraska, Nebraskans, right? And slowly, slowly, that sets this boulder down the hillside. The momentum is now behind other states doing the same thing. That tends to be what happens when a big superpower, you know, collapses and reaches its conclusion.
That's right. Good talk, Pox. You're kicking ass with these streams, man. I'm looking forward to seeing what you got for the rest of the year too, man. And I'm glad you're giving love to Telegram too. You know, there's not very many people giving Telegram love. Even it has like literally everything we need, you know. So good on you, man.
This is something that I was going to talk about with Woz on Millennial, but we just ended up having a completely improvised conversation. But one of the things I had sent him was, let's talk about Telegram. Let's talk about how enjoyable it is, how useful it is compared to, you know, Twitter, because both Woz and I think really are enjoying Telegram and trying to get as much out of it as possible. And Woz in particular, you know, had that traumatic experience with Twitter, whereas I've never really cared too much about Twitter. I was banned multiple times on multiple, you know, small scale sock accounts, you know. Whereas, you know, for Woz, being on Twitter was a big deal, and being kicked off Twitter was an even bigger deal. And so I had sent him an idea. Let's talk about the pros and cons on being on, of being on Twitter, of being on Telegram, etc. And we never got around to it. But yeah, I do enjoy being on Telegram. I'm aware that the founder of Telegram is a WEF member. Everyone in their and their dog seems to be a WEF member. But I do think that Telegram seems to be pro free speech. You know, there's a problem with bots and spam. But I think for the most part, we're allowed to express ourselves here. I like that there's no character limit to posts, really. I can make lengthy posts if I want to. There's lots of features like these streams that you can engage in. So yeah, I think it's a great platform, and I'm glad you enjoy the I'm glad you enjoy these streams. Glad to hear it.
Yes, sir. All right. Take it easy, Pox. I'm going to pop out, buddy.
All right. Have a good night.